Okay. If you're trying to stay with the book, with where we are, this is chapter 7 and 8 this week. Okay, we're going to be doing about 2 chapters at a pop until we're done. Obviously, no Sunday school next week, but then we'll every Sunday in April we'll meet and then we'll be done. Okay. So today we're going to talk about the ascension and how the ascension and heaven relate to each other, which is going to help us clarify what the Bible is talking about with heaven and Jesus' return as well. So these concepts kind of belong in a cluster that are mutually informing and that I hope will be helpful to us. So the ascension of Jesus, do you know in what parts of the New Testament, this is high-level Bible trivia now, do you know in what parts of the New Testament the ascension of Jesus is mentioned directly?
The Gospel in Acts.
It Acts and one of the Gospels. Do you know which one?
Matthew.
Dun, dun, dun. Not Luke. Matthew. Luke is correct. All right. Now you want to go to the bonus round. Okay. Yeah, there we are. Only in Luke and Acts, which are, of course, companion books. Okay, you read the beginning of Acts. In my first book, O Theophilus, I wrote to you about all that Jesus began to do and teach. So Acts is volume 2 of Luke. It's only there that we have the ascension narrated. Okay? So Luke is the only person in the New Testament who believes in the ascension. Wrong. Okay. Because in the rest of the New Testament, it's just assumed. Now, how do we assume that it's assumed? Well, the ascension signifies for us that Jesus is no longer present in the world as he was before his ascension. Okay? He is no longer walking among us in the same way that you and I are walking among us. But he is enthroned in heaven in the place of authority, from which place he is ruling over everything, and from which place he promises that he will return. Okay? So that concept is very much a part of everything. And so I do not object at all. If you think, well, you know, I think the ascension is in Matthew. Well, it's not narrated. Matthew never says he goes to heaven. But when Jesus says, all authority is given to me in heaven and on earth, well, that's kind of the bottom line of the ascension. Okay? That Jesus is on the throne of heaven, as it were. So it is that when we any place that we see this idea introduced that says Jesus is now in heaven, Jesus rules from heaven, Jesus pours out his spirit on his people, he does this from heaven, and Jesus will return. Now, for a lot of folk in our world and this is not just a modern problem, this is also a pre-modern problem. There has been a tendency to kind of collapse together the idea of Jesus' resurrection and his ascension. And I'll give you a kind of an example, I think I may have mentioned it before, of something that shows how these ideas can be collapsed. In the U.S. Capitol building, there is a mural on a ceiling, the Apotheosis of Washington. Okay, this is George Washington after his death being ushered up into heaven by angels. Okay, this to me, I've never been in that part of the Capitol. I don't think I've ever been in the Capitol building, actually. Okay, but I've never seen this myself. Of all the, there are wonderful things in the Capitol and there are weird things in the Capitol because America is wonderful and it's weird. Of all the weird things, I think the Apotheosis of Washington would weird me out the most. I mean, I think a lot of George Washington, but the idea of depicting him on a mural on the ceiling being lifted up into heaven by angels is a bit much for me. Okay, so an apotheosis is a taking up to God. Now, in kind of popular thought, an apotheosis is what happens to a really good, important person when they die and their spirit is taken up to heaven. Now, do you see how for some people that can kind of be collapsed into resurrection if they started with the idea that, oh, resurrection simply means that Jesus is alive even though he died. Okay. As we've been talking, resurrection is much more than just Jesus is alive even though he died. Resurrection is Jesus' body is alive again. That the body he died in is now the body that he is alive in again. Okay. So when we're talking about Jesus' ascension, thanks, Isaiah. When we're talking about Jesus, it's my pen especially that I'm after, right? This is my precious. That was a huge act of trust on my part. That's about as much trust as I will exercise, right, dear? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Jesus' resurrection is not just his spirit. It's the whole person. That's kind of the number one concept that we're talking about the whole time. So his ascension, then, is not simply his being received in spirit in heaven as a great hero. His ascension is his whole person in heaven. And this is important, body and spirit, okay? Body is not something that Jesus takes on temporarily when he becomes human in the biblical narrative. This is something we don't often think about, because we think of heaven as a place that only spirits are in. But the biblical affirmation is no, Jesus arises in the same human body he died in. So he's incarnate at his conception, okay, and at his birth, and in his life, and in his death, and in his resurrection. And when he ascends, he doesn't shed his body. He keeps it, okay? So Christ remains eternally incarnate. He becomes incarnate at his conception. He becomes human at his conception, but he remains human as well as divine. How divine, how human, 100%, 100%. That doesn't add up. Incarnation and Trinity work differently than other things. Okay, that's, you know, God is different from other things that we're familiar with in that way. So we need to think, first of all, of the ascended Jesus as Jesus in his body. Okay, now you notice how that kind of begins to break up a kind of ethereal notion of heaven, doesn't it? Okay, heaven maybe just became a little bit different. So there's at least one dude with a body there. Okay. All right, so how does that work? Well, I appreciate the way Wright talks about heaven in this regard as, you know, we tend to think of he says, we tend to have a receptacle idea of heaven and earth, kind of two containers. There's an earth container where everyone is corporeal, you know, everyone has a body, everything is physical, and so forth. And there's a heaven container where everything is spirit. And they're kind of two containers, and you can be in one container or you can be in the other container. Well, he suggests instead of a receptacle relationship, a receptacle concept, and also heaven is up, earth is down. Up is, of course, a very problematic concept when you realize that earth is a sphere. We can leave all of that aside. And by the way, people in Jesus' time who were informed by Greek thought knew that the earth was a sphere because there was a Greek who had measured the circumference of the earth pretty accurately, doing some pretty cool things in Egypt during the summer solstice. No, the vernal equinox. One or the other. Anyway, okay. I forget what that was. I even forget what I was talking about now. Wright suggests thinking of heaven and earth not as separate receptacles, but in a relational setting. Heaven, he says, is a place from which one can be also present everywhere on earth at the same time. Okay. So Jesus in heaven, though he is physically in heaven and physically in the proper sense of the word, in a body, is also present on earth everywhere. Okay? Where what might we get that idea? I am with you always, end of Matthew. Okay? How is he present? He has poured out his spirit on his people. How is he present? Those who worship him worship in spirit and in truth. John chapter 4. You know, all of these kinds of concepts. So from heaven, Jesus can both be absent from the world physically and present in the world everywhere all the time. What does that empower? What does that enable? Rule, okay, reigning, exercising authority in that way. So Jesus ascended to heaven then, you know, the term that Peter uses in his speech in Pentecost in Acts chapter 2 is that he has ascended to heaven from which he sits at God's right hand, meaning he shares God's throne. And his pouring out of the Spirit on his people is the demonstration of his authority. This is how he reigns. He reigns through his Spirit in his people. And this then is how we understand those kinds of things going on at that point. Now, at this point, we might be thinking, this is super weird. Okay. Well, let's admit, the whole concept of heaven is super weird, no matter how you conceive it, right? It is beyond our immediate sensory experience. So we're on a faith journey, irrespective of how we look at this. I wrote this down from the book because this could kind of like go on my tombstone. Part of Christian belief is to find out what's true about Jesus and let that challenge our culture. And you know, what's true about Jesus, you know, as Christians would say, is what is revealed in the New Testament. You know, what's revealed in the Gospels, in Acts, in the Epistles. About all of this, so we're kind of getting ourselves reoriented to what's the real core of the theology of the Bible, as we think about this idea. So all right. So if Jesus is in heaven, you know, I've got this kind of what's up here. Okay, if he has ascended to heaven, then so what? And the answer here is this means Jesus is king. Okay, and here we get to kind of the beginning of why we're even doing this discussion right now. Okay, last fall we did the course on faith and politics, and that was very deliberate because politics is kind of heating up, and we wanted to do it before fall, you know, when everybody loses their mind this fall, right? Do it a year in advance while everyone's still got, like, you know, reasonable blood pressure and everything. Of course, I just want to remind you all, we live in Illinois, okay? And that isn't to say that elections are unfair here, but, you know, as you know, if Illinois goes Republican, okay, in a presidential election, it's going to be like 450 electoral votes and it won't matter anyway. So, you know, that's just the nature of politics. But this is kind of a follow-up to that, because the question is, okay, how do we live in the world as people who are of Christian faith? And the shortest form of the answer is Jesus is king. But then the question comes, well, what exactly does that mean? Because there are a lot of people who seem to want to enthrone Jesus politically, and how does that go about? Now, here we're also in kind of caught in the vice of culture, as it were, because historically, Western civilization has been dominated by the history of Europe of the merging of the authority of church and state. The idea that the monarch is a kind of a divine representative, and that the state operates by the authority of God, is mediated through the church, etc. Of course, you get into the history there and you discover kings and popes are always arguing with each other, you know, and sometimes it's who do I get to marry, Henry VIII, and things of this nature. But that history is there. And because that worked out poorly over time in Europe in the you know, after really ruinous religious wars in the 16th and 17th century, in the 18th century, the Enlightenment comes along and says, let's stop doing that. Okay? Of course, the United States is a product of that Enlightenment. One of the great Enlightenment documents is the Declaration of Independence, which says the natural conditions of human beings is to be free, that our Creator did not empower monarchs, but endowed individuals with unalienable rights, and so forth. Good, strong Enlightenment thinking. That tends to move us into the idea, then, that faith is not a public thing, but a private thing. You are entitled to have your faith, whatever you want to have, and to live it out as you want, but it doesn't really belong in discussion in the public square. Now, we could get into whether that's what the American founders actually thought, and I don't necessarily think that it is. I'm just talking about kind of tendencies of thought that work in this direction. So Jesus is king in a lot of popular thought, and I'm going to put little frowny faces here so we recognize this is not where we want to go. Okay, one frowny face is, let's call it, Christianized government. The government should be the thing that rules as Jesus' vice regent. Okay? So the government is deliberately operating as, okay, we submit to Jesus and we are doing the work of Jesus, etc., etc., monarch or parliament or whatever it might be. That's one alternative. The other alternative is privatized Christianity. Okay. These are the two ways that people tend to look at this. It's very interesting to notice how right now, this is kind of where a lot of our debate about these kinds of things exist in our time. There are people who are saying, we want the government to reflect Christian values, to support Christian values, to support Christian promote Christian values. You know, we would like an explicitly Christian government. You can go all kinds of directions with this, okay? And on the other side, no. Religion should be private. You can vote your conscience on these things, but you can't force your faith on other people through the power of government, etc. Okay? And those are kind of irreconcilable positions. Okay, now, so the question, I think, then is there an alternative to these, and do they match out with what we read in the New Testament? Well, in the New Testament, is the aim of Jesus and his followers to Christianize government, to kind of take over the Roman Empire? One narrative of the history of the church is struggle through three centuries, and then Constantine comes along and says, I'm going to make Christianity the official religion of the Roman Empire, and this then is victory. Okay, we finally won. We finally took over. And things go really well after that. Okay, and they continue to go well in Europe for, you know, a number of centuries until then, until everything finally falls apart. No, things are always falling apart. Yeah, that was not going on. But what about biblically? Is this biblically what's going on? Well, on the one hand, we need to recognize that the entire Christian message is always challenging worldly authorities. And that's true irrespective of what they are. The worldly authority of government, the worldly authority of wealth, the worldly authority of power, however it is manifested, even in a religious context. Okay, let's kind of run through this. One of my favorite observations to make with people is the way that the story of the birth of Jesus in Luke is putting a thumb in the eye of the Roman government. Okay, when you're reading about the birth of Jesus in Luke, in the days of Caesar Augustus, there went forth a decree that all the world should be taxed. Okay, well, right there, they're just making fun. Luke is making fun of the way the Romans say they rule the whole world, because everybody knows they don't. but they pretend like they do. Okay, so he's using their stuff, and he talks about that decree, and then so Caesar is king, and he rules the world by making everybody register for taxes, and then meanwhile Jesus is born in Bethlehem and is put in a feeding trough for animals, which is about as poor as you can get. Okay, then we go out to the shepherds, and the angel shows up and says, "I have good news for you." And good news is a phrase in the Roman world that would be used to refer to the announcement of the birth of a new king. Okay? So a new king is born. This is, you know, the Romans would send out the message, "We have good news, there's a new king. Tiberius has been replaced by Gaius Caligula." That went well. If you know anything about that guy. That would be an announcement of good news. "I have good news. Today is born for you in the city of David," which is a way of talking about Bethlehem that emphasizes the great king of the past, David, to whom God promised he would have a son or a seed who would be the even greater king whose throne God would establish forever. And then a savior. Savior being a word that we're very familiar with, but actually only occurs in the New Testament about 25 times, because it was often a political word in the Roman world. Lots of inscriptions and declarations and so forth. This general is a savior, this Caesar is a savior, etc. So that's a challenge to the rule of Caesar, who is Christ, also a king word, anointed one, king, the Lord. In the Roman world, you say Caesar is Lord as a way of showing your loyalty there. Okay, and then there's a multitude of the heavenly host being an army. A host means army there. I would love to see a translation say a big army of angels. That would be great. But what do? They don't fight, they sing. Glory to God in the highest, on earth peace. What do the Romans say they bring? Peace, etc. So the whole thing is just Rome, you know, like the Three Stooges, right in the eye. No notion of we're taking over the government, but everything is the government is not the real authority. Okay, it is not the real thing that rules. It's just being bypassed. Okay. And then as we see this develop, it's, you know, Romans says, 1 Peter says, submit to the king. Why do you submit to the king? Well, first of all, because as a Christian, you submit to everybody. You don't seek your own good, your own authority. Why don't you? Because your Lord, your king, surrendered himself for the sake of other people. So the idea of we're taking over just doesn't fit that model. When people come to our, this is thinking, you know, in our calendar for this week on the church calendar. When Jesus says to his disciples, "Arise, let us go, the Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of sinners," that sounds an awful lot like let's get up and run away or let's get up and fight. And he doesn't do either one. Peter pulls out a sword, he says, "Put the sword away, knucklehead," which is interesting because in Luke narrates this portion in particular. In the upper room, Jesus says, "Remember when I sent you out without a staff? Yeah. Well, now take a staff, take a money bag, take a sword." And they say, "Duh, we have two swords," not realizing he's speaking metaphorically. And so when they pull out the literal sword, Jesus says, "Put that away. Okay, we're not going to fight these guys." This is one of Bill's songs, if you were here on Thursday. He didn't run, he didn't fight. I got the lyrics wrong. Bill's lyrics are better. That is the case. He surrenders himself willingly. So why do you submit to the king? Submitting is what Christians do. Who do you submit to? Everybody. When? All the time. That's a weird way to run your life. Yeah, it is. Very upside down. Okay, so you submit to the king, and you recognize that in the fallen world that government can and should operate to bring at least an approximation of justice. In Romans, the king is, the government is God's instrument for bringing justice. Does it do it perfectly? Oh, of course not. But there's no idea of Christianizing the government. There is an idea of submitting to it, but it's a recognition we submit to it because we are really always in submission to the authority of Christ, the one who submits. Now, does this mean that we privatize things? Does this mean we say, well, this is my belief, and it's my business, but it has nothing to do with you? No, that's not how this works at all. The ascension, the life, the death, the resurrection, the ascension of Jesus are all public truths. They're things that people have seen, that they have witnessed. They're not simply beliefs that people have come to, you know, through reasoning or hopes or dreams or something like that. All roads lead to this, but it is a public truth. It's witnessed in the same way that you would witness, you know, a car accident that might happen in front of you, or any event that you might see. So it is never by nature private. It is always by nature public. It's always by nature something that can be discussed rationally and openly. You know, why do you believe in Jesus? Well, there's about 100 reasons, but one of the big ones is this all happened in public. You know, it wasn't as if it was, you know, and yeah, granted, we're removed by a number of centuries in time and space, but that doesn't mean that that kind of information is not recoverable. We deal with knowledge of the past all the time on the basis of the testimony of other people, of things that happened in public. So this is fundamentally a public thing. And if these things that happened did indeed happen and have the meaning that those who saw them happen say they have, which the church in turn affirms, this is not a private matter any longer. Okay, so what's the idea here? Well, the idea is that that marker no longer has any ink in it. The idea is 2 Corinthians 4:10. Okay, so let's look that up. And this is just one of many texts that we could cite in this direction to describe what's going on. I have a important place in my mind and heart for 2 Corinthians because, first of all, I think it's the hardest book of the New Testament. And you're thinking, harder than the book of Revelation? Oh, yeah. Revelation is easy once you kind of understand it's a comic book without pictures. And I don't say that to demean it, okay? I have a lot of respect for the art that goes into and the craft of a comic book. But, you know, everything is bigger than life in Revelation. That's the idea. And it's all kind of metaphorically referring not to specific events but to ideas and recurring things that are happening in life and so forth. 2 Corinthians is hard because Paul is just pouring out his gut. And he's doing it at some points in a way that people do when they're pouring out their guts. It doesn't immediately connect up idea to idea. You have to kind of sit with the person and listen to understand what he's really saying and what that is all about. So in 1 Corinthians, he begins after he's done his greeting and thanksgiving at the beginning, where he repeatedly refers to the God of comfort who comforts us so we can comfort one another. Comfort, 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 comfort. And then he says, I want you to know, you know, things have been so tough, I have despaired even of life. You know, I have been at the absolute bottom. What we would call probably situational depression, you know, is what Paul is in. And he's discussing his struggles and the paradox of Christian life and so forth. And then in chapter 4, there's a kind of a climax that comes to this. And you look at the 10th verse where he says, always carrying in the body the death of Jesus so that the life of Jesus may also be manifested in our bodies. Okay? Carrying in our bodies the death of Jesus so that the life of Jesus is manifested. This is how Jesus reigns as king in the world. Okay? It's in Christians who live the death and life of Jesus in their daily life. So what does it mean to always carry around the death of Jesus? Well, it means, first of all, you're going to have a hard time. You know, you're going to have difficulties, you're going to have disappointments, you're going to have struggles, you're going to have pain, you're going to have grief, you're going to suffer. You yourself are going to die, okay? Unless that's interrupted by Jesus' return, which we'll have a little bit to say about if I can shut up. So, you know, it means that. But also, you know, so that the life of Jesus can be manifested. Well, death and life being manifested, in the midst of all of this suffering, we are nevertheless sustained. We are nevertheless, as Paul says, comforted. We are nevertheless empowered. And in both of those things, we're not just suffering for suffering's sake and being, you know, built up as a compensation for that. We are, you know, Jesus doesn't just die because suffering is virtuous. Jesus dies for the sake of other people. He dies for others. He dies in their service, giving himself for them. This is what it is to carry about the death of Jesus in our bodies. We live for others, as we said just a few minutes ago. We submit to other people all the time, which doesn't mean we just do whatever they say. It means we're always acting in their interest, for their benefit, not for our own benefit. We're not interested in our own stuff. We're interested in other people's stuff. Okay. Now that, in practical terms, that leads to things like, you know, I got to eat, I got to sleep, I got to take care of myself, or else I'll die, you know, or collapse, and I won't be able to serve other people. It isn't as if, you know, I want to make sure we keep that in perspective. But that is how the life of Jesus, the reign of Jesus, is manifested in the world. And notice how particular that is. Okay, because how does Jesus become king? His crucifixion is the beginning of his enthronement. This is another way that the Gospels picture the death of Jesus. Another way that the Gospels put this story together in just a really fascinating sequence, I think, is when James and John in Matthew and Mark come to Jesus, or Matthew makes it even worse, their mother comes to Jesus and asks that they sit at Jesus' right and left hand when he come into the kingdom. You know, I want to be prime minister and I want to be chancellor of the exchequer. You know, that's kind of the thing. And Jesus says, you know, can you drink of my cup and be baptized with my baptism? And they say, duh, yeah, not knowing he's talking about his death. And then he says, well, you will drink of my cup and be baptized with my baptism, but to sit at my right and left is not for me to assign, but for the Father. Now, alert readers will then notice that the next time that right and left are mentioned in Matthew and Mark, it is, anybody have a guess? At Jesus' crucifixion, where there are two rebels who are crucified on his right and left hand. Now, what does that signify? This is Jesus' enthronement, okay? And there are other elements of that. If you read through the account of Jesus' death, and I would strongly urge you this week to take a moment just to read any one of the four Gospels' account of Jesus' death itself. I don't think that we read that enough. We'll be reflecting on it on Good Friday in a very special way, but I'd encourage you to read that. When you do, notice all the king language that's in it. You know, Pilate puts the inscription above Jesus, says, Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews. He saved others, let him save himself. If you are the Christ, and Christ means king, anointed one, come down from the cross. And of course, it's because he is the king that he won't come down from the cross. And all of these elements, the way that Jesus is mocked as king and so forth, it's enthronement. But it's paradoxical enthronement, because any other king becomes king not by letting his enemies kill him, but by killing his enemies. So Jesus has taken this and turned it completely upside down. So always carrying around in our lives, in our bodies, in the way that we're living in the world, the death of Jesus, the way Jesus becomes king by dying, for the sake of others, so that the life of Jesus may be manifest. This is how the fact that Jesus is not just alive, but reigns, is manifest. And this is the real power of God at work in the world. Okay. Now, what that's interesting, because what that means is we're not Christianizing the government, but if you're a Christian who works in government, you're living as a Christian, which means you're subverting your own ambition for the sake of, you know, doing good for others, you know, in the name of Jesus. I'm going to give a specific example of this kind of thing, and then I'm going to cut this off and talk about Jesus' return, before Jesus returns. Does the name Michael Gerson mean anything to any of you? Okay. He was most recently, he died about, it's been what, a year? Yeah, about a year and a half. I think he died in the late fall of 22. Okay, he was for years and years a columnist with the Washington Post, but he was a speechwriter for George W. Bush. Okay, now I'll bring in another of my favorite things, which some of you have heard me mention before. Have you heard of the PEPFAR program? The President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. This was a program that was introduced in the Bush administration, which makes medication available to HIV-positive people in Africa, where has been a huge HIV/AIDS epidemic, at basically no cost at the point of use, so that poor Africans can have the medication that keeps them alive, keeps their children alive, you know, that has basically squelched the AIDS epidemic. Okay, it is estimated that the PEPFAR program has saved 25 million lives. I'm sorry, I get choked up when I think about this. Michael, I didn't plan on doing this. Okay, Michael Gerson was a wonderful, wonderful Christian person and promoted this idea within the Bush administration because he saw it as something that would bring blessing to people. Now, I guarantee you, you ask 99 people in this country what they think of George W. Bush, and they will not mention PEPFAR. Okay? Michael Gerson, you don't know his name. I do, because I'm special. That was not Christianizing government, but Christians in government using where they were to do something which is a benefit to other people. Okay, which I think mirrors that. So, you know, this is I think the way that we live in this kind of situation. All right, let's talk about Jesus' return. If all of this is all of that, then you know, how do we understand Jesus' return? Let me talk about another word here, and it is a Greek word which is used multiple times in the New Testament to refer to Jesus' return. The word is parousia. It's often in English translation translated as return or coming. Okay, Matthew 24, what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? Okay, this word is used in the period of the New Testament to refer to the arrival of a powerful ruler who begins to rule I'm going to change the way I'm putting that because I realized I'm going to have bad sentence structure. Powerful ruler now ruling with his presence. Okay. In the Roman world, the emperor, the king, rules everything from Rome. But if he comes to your town, he rules from where you are. And his arrival is a parousia. His arrival and his presence is a parousia. It is his presence as an authority to rule. He's been ruling before, but now he's ruling present with you. Okay. This is the primary term that the New Testament is using to refer to the return of Jesus, and it captures the idea. What does the return of Jesus mean? It means he is ruling as he did before, but now he is ruling physically present. And with that physical presence comes a change, a renewal of the world, so that the world is brought into complete subjection to his rule. Okay, so this is the final overthrowing of all of the powers, the final defeat of his enemies and so forth. Now, it's helpful to realize that if we back up here and plug in the resurrection, even before everything that we're talking about, that we're really talking about one whole big conglomeration of Jesus is king. Jesus is victorious. Jesus is overcoming the problem of sin and rebellion and evil that is in the world, and bringing this to its conclusion. Okay, and so as we think about this, one of the things we recognize is that sometimes when Jesus, well, for example, Wright would say, and I would lean in this direction as well, when Jesus stands before the Sanhedrin at his trial, when he's on trial for his life, and he's asked, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed One?" He says, "I am, and henceforth you will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven." Okay? That he's not there referring primarily to his return, he's referring to his resurrection. Okay. Wait, there are no clouds there. Yeah, well, that was never a weather report. Okay, cloud is it's evoking the presence of God, in the Exodus. Okay, and it's also important to realize he's accessing an Old Testament text, Daniel chapter 7, which is primarily about God coming to Israel after the Exodus to redeem them. So he's merging together himself with God coming, okay, he's affirming his divinity, and saying, you're going to know this when I'm raised from the dead. Okay, I think the same thing is going on when Jesus says, coming into Jerusalem, 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 that kills the prophets, stones those who were sent to her. How often I wanted to gather you like a hen gathers its chicks, but now you will not see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. It's referring to his resurrection. Okay, you're going to know who I am when I'm raised from the dead. But that then is kind of appropriately applied to his return as well, which is the final and full revelation of himself. Okay, and the full revelation in another direction of how the world has been governed by the one who is in rebellion against God. He is revealed for who he is. Rather the way that Toto pulls back the curtain on the wizard in The Wizard of Oz. Okay, and you find out he was never a wizard at all. So, thoughts, questions, comments, observations, rude remarks. Maggie's not here, so somebody else is going to have to talk. All right, thanks for listening to me yammer on for 50 minutes. So, I appreciate that. No Sunday school next week, and then 4 weeks in a row. Okay? Ta-ta for now.